Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the battle space of that war, of course, the Department of State is a very big player. It is not always constructively so, but when it is usually because it's being influenced by people like our first guest. He is Christian Whiten. He has served in the senior reaches of that department, including most recently as a man helping Rex Tillerson, the now outgoing Secretary of State. As we speak to him, the hopefully incoming Secretary of State, Michael Pompeo, is undergoing examination by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has been keeping an eye on those proceedings, and I'm very anxious to get a sense from him as to both the candidate and the auto de fe that he is being subjected to at the moment. Christian Whiten is the author of a very important book entitled Smart Power: Between Diplomacy and War. He's a practitioner of it. We're always delighted to catch up with him. Welcome back, Christian. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
So let's start with Mike Pompeo. You've doubtless had experience observing him, at least, if not close at hand, from a far remove. What do you make of this nominee, and how do you think he's handling himself so far in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee?
Well, so far, so good, Frank. I did see Pompeo a little bit at the transition when I was working on getting Tillerson and Haley confirmed. And, you know, very approachable, good guy, humble, knowledgeable, smart. And you're seeing that come across today again in the confirmation hearing. There's the usual sort of half hour plus of Kabuki theater where he's being introduced, where he's going through his opening remarks, where senators themselves bloviate at length.
Unfortunately, that's not confined to the opening half hour in my experience. The bloviating goes on and on and on.
That's what they're best at, the world's greatest deliberative body. A couple of things struck me at first. One is there's a lot of focus, especially in his opening remarks and also in his tenure at the CIA, to management. And, you know, State has lacked a political team. There are, of course, some good people over there doing very good work, but they have been small in number, few in number. And I think Pompeo will move rapidly to fill that with a real political network, because that's really how you get things done at the State Department. Otherwise, it just turns into a big episode of Yes, Minister.
But isn't the problem to some extent, and again, you were working with Rex Tillerson, the Senate and its deliberations, such as they are, about these various political appointments, at least at the, you know, assistant secretary and above level?
That is a big problem, both with ambassadors and with assistant secretaries. There are people like Papa Doug Manchester, who, you know, we haven't had a ambassador to the Bahamas since 2012. I mean, think of it as a, you know, massively important post, but it is in that part of the world. And we haven't had an ambassador to Germany during the entire Trump administration. And there are a couple things going on over there, and that is the fault of the Senate. However, even at the deputy assistant secretary level and other Schedule Cs, as they're called, that has been also sort of the fault of the State Department, of the political team that was there before. So that's something that Pompeo can switch tomorrow.
Any prognosis on his prospects for confirmation?
It's looking pretty good. You know, the fact that Menendez is already in favor of him, Menendez being the ranking member, the senior most Democrat on the committee, and of course, Corker is in favor for him. I was a little worried at the early outset because Rand Paul is a no because of Pompeo and you know, not doing what Rand wants to do on Iraq and prisoners and things like that. And once you lose one Republican, there's always the worry that if the Democrats block vote, then you will lose, because Republicans only have a one vote margin on that committee. In fact, most Senate committees. But the fact, you know, previously Kane voted in favor of Pompeo on the floor for CIA director. So that's a probable yes on the committee. Menendez, and who knows, maybe he can pick up some more. And I think he's saying all the right things. He prioritized Russia, which is what they want to hear, even though I don't think that's actually the biggest threat in the world by a long shot. But nonetheless, he seems to be doing the right things.
Good. Let me ask you about two other topics quickly, if I can, Christian Whiten. One is John Bolton, a man both of us, I think, have come to know and admire over the years, is now, of course, the National Security Advisor to the president. Your thoughts on that appointment as well?
I think it's a great appointment. And, you know, we've heard all the good things about John. Skepticism about the Iran deal, skepticism about China, skepticism about getting the deal of the century out of North Korea. But on the positive side, John really is a good bureaucratic negotiator and knows how to move things through a bureaucracy, I should say. That's very important. I think that's something that, you know, some of the generals in the administration aren't necessarily terrific at. They have many skills and many things that are important, but the politics and the bureaucratic warfare, they're maybe not quite as skilled at. And that's where he can really shine, is enforcing Trump's decision down on the bureaucracy.
Yeah. Well, I think being aligned with the president's views on these things is a big start. Finally, and very quickly, Christian Whiten, what do you make of where we are with respect to Syria at the moment? We're going to talk more about this at length with our next guest, David Goldman, but I'd be very interested in your reading on the situation, having, as I said, been involved in global affairs for some time in the Department of State.
I think Trump is right. His two instincts. One is that Assad has to pay a price for using chemical weapons, and we should control escalatory dominance. And it should be a bigger price than he paid last time, since he didn't learn and he didn't refuse to use them subsequently. So I think we're going to see something. It'll be in conjunction with the Brits and the French, and that will be good. But more importantly, I think Trump's instinct that as we accomplish our mission in Syria and kill ISIS, then we don't need to get involved in a quagmire there. We will have interests, but we're not going to turn the place into Beverly Hills, nor should we try, and that we need to keep our powder dry for bigger threats like China and like Islamism as a political force, rather than sort of, you know, managing the outcome or going to war against Assad specifically.
On that point about Islamism, one of the problems, as you know, that we've had for some time, in fact, it's going to be used, I think, to hector Mike Pompeo in the course of this hearing as well, is that the U.S. government has not been terribly squared away on what I think of as Sharia supremacism, really, as a totalitarian ideology. President Trump, as a candidate, couldn't have been more clear about that as the problem and about, you know, his determination to address it as such and to counter it. Do you anticipate that this is going to be a priority and get actually properly handled by the president's new national security team?
I've hoped for so long, I'm a little hesitant to call a prognosis or give a positive one, because I would just say there are people in the government who, given the signal to fight the ideology, are really willing and able. There are other people who, you know, are taking the political correct view that Islamism is too close to Islam, and they are, you know, too dumb to figure out one is a political ideology. And anyway, so I hope springs eternal. I think this is the best chance we've had since 9/11 to get this right.
We have a bureaucracy, and we've been deeply penetrated, I think, by people who are playing for that other team. So those are working against this opportunity. Christian Whiten, you are a brilliant practitioner of smart power between diplomacy and war, the title of your book. As senior fellow at the Center for the National Interest and a senior vice president for Banner Public Affairs, I know you will keep up the good work. As promised, David Goldman is up next. Spengler, we'll talk with him about Syria. Do we have a strategy? And if not, what should it be? Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's our now regular visit, I'm very pleased to say, with David Goldman time. It is a chance to pick the brains of a man whose brains are formidable indeed, particularly in matters involving economics and strategy, and he is kind enough to lend some time to us on a regular basis now when he's not writing his column under the pseudonym of Spengler at Asia Times or Managing Reorient Group Limited. He is writing feverishly and otherwise contributing to the public policy debate, so we're always grateful for the moments he spares us to walk us through some important developments that he's tracking and that we need to. David Goldman, welcome back. So good to have you as always.
Frank, great pleasure.
Let me ask you first, David, to talk a little bit about Syria. I know you cover Asia intensively, but you're a free-range observer of the very important developments of our time, and certainly what's going down at the moment in Syria would qualify. What is, as you see it, the state of play, point one, and point two, what should we be doing as a country with respect to that state of play?
Well, the state of play is that Russia, Turkey, and Iran are dividing the country amongst them. With support from Iranian irregulars, 80,000 on the ground, and Russian air support, the brutal Assad government has pretty much won the civil war. Turkey is a serious factor. They can make a lot of trouble by supporting various Sunni rebels against Assad. But as long as Assad and Russia give Turkey free rein to mop up the Kurds in the north, the Turks will play ball. And although they've got disagreements, they'll all work together behind our back. Bottom line, Frank, is if we don't have boots on the ground, we don't have any say in there. And the Kurds, the people who defeated ISIS, were supposed to be our boots on the ground, but we've thrown them under the bus in order to appease Turkey because too many people in Washington are worried that Turkey is going to leave NATO and that would be a terrible disaster. Fact is, Turkey has already, for intents and purposes, done that. They've worked with Russia and Iran. We have nothing to lose. So the way to respond is go back to supporting the Kurds and have a viable pro-American fighting force in the area. That's where you get a seat at the table.
Yeah. You know, this is a case of, well, one great mind and one not so great mind thinking alike. I think, David, I've been opining of late that we do need to do exactly as you say, plus throw into the mix support Israel as she confronts an increasingly existential threat from this combination of bad actors on the other side of their northern border with Syria, to say nothing of what could rain down on them at any moment from Hezbollah forces arrayed in Lebanon. But to this point, it does seem to me that as we argue in a new book to which you have contributed, which should be out next week, entitled Turkey Ally No More, that in fact, Turkey has, for all intents and purposes, ceased to be a reliable partner for the United States. The question has arisen, they haven't exactly left NATO. They may be betraying it, and there doesn't seem to be any formal vehicle for, you know, removing them from it. What is your advice about that? How do we clean up that particular mess?
Well, the diplomatic procedures for expelling a member from NATO are complex. I wouldn't worry about the diplomatic nicety. I would worry about putting a collar on the neo-Ottoman expansionist Islamic maniac running this place, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan has massive economic problems. He has massive demographic problems. The Kurds are having twice as many kids as ethnic Turks. The place is going to be majority Kurdish under the age of 30 in a generation. And what we can do is, first of all, put a squeeze on his finance. That's his Achilles heel, because like a lot of third world dictators who've run the country with a massive credit bubble, the currency's been crashing lately, inflation's out of control. We should limit his room to maneuver by hurting him economically, and we should give the Kurds the ability to fight back against this Turkish invasion of northern Syria. That might involve such things as some handheld anti-aircraft missiles falling off the back of a truck.
This is the Stinger option, which was used to very considerable effect, of course, in Afghanistan by my old boss, Ronald Reagan. Not without some blowback, some would argue, but nonetheless, it was quite strategically important on the ground there.
The Kurds are the ones who crushed ISIS. They're tough. They're willing to fight. They don't have the heavy weapons to deal with Turkish aerial bombardment, although they've made shots with the Turkish tanks, because they do have anti-tank weapons. Looking ahead to Iran, which is our biggest strategic headache in the region, The Kurds are the key to regime change in Iran. 10% of the Iranian population are ethnic Kurds. And if we could help them get together with the Kurds of northern Iraq and Syria, that would give us a very powerful lever for regime change, along with other ethnic minorities in Iran, such as the Iranian Arabs and the Balochis in the southeast of the country. And I strongly believe that regime change should be our objective. Their economy's in free fall. They've got demonstrations and riots almost every day. No country perhaps ever was so ripe for regime change as Iran is right now.
Let me ask you, because I'm very sympathetic to this both remedy, as you say, and the way to bring it about by fracturing the country and helping its elements to bring it down, the regime. There are those who would argue if you actually took steps to help the Kurds advance essentially the agenda of an independent Kurdistan made up of not only Iranian Kurds, but those in Turkey, also in Iraq, also in Syria, that you would have brought on essentially a regional war with all of the countries who were being induced to give up those populations and their territory as a kind of conflict of the first order. What are your thoughts on that, David Goldman?
Probably, eventually, you're going to have a breakup of Iraq. There's going to be an independent Kurdistan in the north, which de facto you've had all along. All you need to do is have an oil-sharing arrangement so that the people down in Baghdad don't feel they're being completely cut out, and that's relatively easy to do. The Turks are going to scream their heads off, but they're already in a regional war. They're already in a full-dress invasion, so I don't see what we have to lose there. In the case of the Iranians, we're already in a war with Iran. Iran has 80,000 Revolutionary Guards and assorted mercenaries rampaging through Syria. So we're already in a war. The question is, are we going to fight for our side, or are we going to sit there from the outside and then just throw a few cruise missiles at it? That's always been the objection. It's always been the excuse to do nothing. It's like Churchill said, you know, you've had a choice of shame or war. You chose shame, and now you're getting war too.
Yes, and the war on others' terms, which is perhaps as unhappy a prospect as any. I am impressed, and I think this is really such a key insight that, as you say, David Goldman, the Kurds have been willing to be the boots on the ground. So with the exception of a relatively small number of American special forces who are being deployed to help them, it's fundamentally on them, and it's insane not to be supporting them, it seems to me, especially in light of the behavior of the Turks. David, some are also arguing, I think particularly in the United States military, that it's whatever one thinks of Turkey's role in NATO these days, the facility that we have at Incirlik, the airbase there, is of such surpassing importance to our operations in the region that we can't afford to lose the Turks, allowing us to make use of that. And again, your response on that, Cal?
My response is that America looks at the world like a monopoly board. We've got a hotel in Park Place. We've got a hotel in Broadway. We've got the Doha Air Base in Qatar. We've got the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. Each of them has a constituency with a reasonable case. The question is, what is our objective? What is our strategy? If we're going to stop Iran with Russian backing from becoming the dominant power between the Mediterranean and the Pakistani border, which is what their objective is, then we're going to have to sacrifice some other things. What's more important and what's less important? What we have is a set of constituencies saying, no, my base is important. You can't touch that. You have to look at it from the top and decide what you're going to keep and what you're going to sacrifice. That's playing chess like the Russians do as opposed to Monopoly.
Well, I think the Iranians invented the game, if I'm not mistaken, so there's a lot of that going along. David Goldman, just lastly, your thoughts on this attack, apparently, using chemical agents. Are you of the view that it was, in fact, the regime that did it? Do you have a sense of that, or do you subscribe to the opinion of some, and it may even be a growing number, that it's not altogether clear.
Well, Secretary Mattis is exactly right to conduct an investigation. The difficulty is, evidently, the gas used is a mix of chlorine and sarin. They're both easy to manufacture. Various Syrian Islamist rebels have been in possession of both of them in the past. So it's certainly possible that the losers in this new arrangement in Syria, namely the Islamist rebels who were getting shut out, wanted to stir the thing up by running a gas attack. Assad's perfectly capable of it. The man's a monster. On the other hand, he's won, so his motive for using a gas attack right now is kind of difficult to divine. So I think the right thing to do is what Matt has said, which is investigate and ascertain the facts before acting.
It's a little unclear how we're going to do that with the Syrian regime and the Russians now apparently in control of the area that was exposed to this stuff, but we'll be following it closely, as I know will you at Asia Times and elsewhere. David Goldman, thank you so much for walking us through this very, very important part of what I call the war for the free world, and we'll catch up with you again, I hope, next week for updates.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, as it's a great pleasure to be from time to time, by Hans von Spakovsky, one of the really brilliant thinkers on matters involving legal and judicial topics, but more generally, public policy, even national security. He comes to all of this via his current job as senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, also by dint of a lot of very important experience in the public sector, notably as a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the Justice Department, also as a member of the Federal Elections Commission. It's always a delight to have him with us, as I say, but especially in a moment when there's some important developments that we're anxious to get his thoughts on. Hans, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Frank.
Let's start with the developments last night. The dark of night, I guess, is what one might call it. There seems to have been a bit of a breakthrough on the efforts that Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and others have been making to get to the bottom of some pretty squirrely business in the Justice Department and FBI. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, the House Intelligence Committee, headed by Nunes, has been investigating the counterintelligence operation that was launched against the Trump campaign. And they served a subpoena on Justice 8 months ago, August of last year, in order to try to get the original memo or electronic communication that launched the investigation. And up until now, Justice had only given them a redacted version, which apparently had big pieces cut out of it. Trey Gowdy actually said that the most important parts had been cut out, the parts that would give them the ability to judge the credibility of the information and whether the FBI had vetted it before they launched the investigation. Anyway, Nunes has been trying to get a full memo, and only this week, after he threatened Rod Rosenstein and Chris Wray, head of the FBI, with contempt and possible impeachment proceedings, suddenly last night they were given access to the entire document.
And what do we know they saw when they got it? Is there any further information available?
We don't know yet, but I think the most important thing for people to understand is that the Justice Department, the FBI, had absolutely no legal justification for withholding the full memo. If they claim there's classified material in it, well, that's not a reason, because it's the House Intelligence Committee that's doing this investigation, and the members of it, as you know, Frank, are cleared to look at classified material. And there is no other way that executive branch agencies can refuse to give documents and information to Congress when it's exercising its oversight function, except for one reason. That's if the president claims executive privilege. And certainly we all know President Trump has not claimed executive privilege over these documents, and there's no way that he would do that.
Yeah. So we are in a holding pattern to discover what was now unredacted and what else accompanied that document. I'm told there may be 1,000 pages of other materials. Is that your understanding as well, Hans?
That's a possibility. I got to tell you, I suspect that the reason DOJ and FBI refuse to turn this over is because of what we have seen from prior information that's been made available, which is that the FBI didn't actually vet or check the credibility of the information they had gotten, which is a basic mistake and basic error.
I would go so far as to say it's malfeasance, Hans. It doesn't seem to me it's just kind of an oversight. It's that they deliberately chose not to do it. But let me switch gears, if I may, because there's so much more to talk to you about, Hans, and I do want to cover several other topics. One of them is you wrote in FoxNews.com about questions that Mark Zuckerberg should have to answer when he testified before the Congress. This was back on April 10th. Did you get answers to those questions? And if not, why not? And what did we learn, in fact, as a result of his appearance?
Well, I actually don't think we learned a lot. I'm continually amazed at how incompetent members of the Senate and the House are at actually asking tough examinations like a lawyer would in a cross-examination. Look, the biggest question that should have been asked, but it was asked in part, but not the right way, was, you know, why did Facebook allow the Obama campaign to keep and use all of its data that it had gotten from Facebook in the 2012 campaign? And yet, when the Trump campaign was using that same kind of data through a company, a political consultant they hired, Cambridge Analytica, Facebook went to them and said, you've got to destroy the data. Now, the supposed excuse given is that, well, the Obama campaign obtained this directly through an app they designed, whereas Cambridge Analytica bought the data from somebody else. I don't really see much difference between those two ways of getting data. The end result is they basically were happy with one political campaign that they supposedly favored using the data, but not with another one who they didn't favor using that kind of data.
Yeah. My understanding is actually, Hans, that Mark Zuckerberg himself was helping the Obama campaign in furtherance of its electoral success. So it wasn't just that they had access to the data through whichever mechanism, but they were actually being guided in its exploitation by the very man that we're, you know, trying to extract information from. One other piece of this, which I think you were concerned about, as am I, and that scarcely got attention in the Senate other than Ted Cruz, to his credit, and somewhat more, but not enough, it seems to me, in the House, was this issue of Mark Zuckerberg's role now in censoring the kind of information that is available to Facebook users. What's your takeaway on all of that?
Well, the takeaway on that was, you know, Ted Cruz went through a list of all these conservative-leaning sites that had been censored by Facebook, including, I think, 24 Catholic sites, and then asked Zuckerberg if he knew of a single liberal site or liberal content that had been censored, and Zuckerberg couldn't list one. And then Zuckerberg, and this is an answer that the rest of his answer a lot of people have ignored, he seemed to try to justify it because he says, well, you know, we're headquartered in Silicon Valley, and that's a very liberal place, as if that's justification for that kind of censorship on Facebook. And he really didn't have an answer for why they were doing that. He I don't know if it was pretend or really was. It was as if he was ignorant of what his own company was doing in this area.
Well, I think ignorance was the best posture he could strike, because all others really play into what I believe is the actual facts of the matter, which is we do have liberals. In fact, according to Breitbart, which has a piece on the subject, a great many of them seem to be Obama people and Hillary Clinton people at that. But they are really now very much involved in discriminating and doing with extreme prejudice harm to conservative sites and the information that they're trying to convey, and favoring in their stead the liberals. So this moves them completely out, as far as I'm concerned, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on it, Hans, out of the category of a neutral purveyor of information. They're now partisans, and the implications of that for an election. Talk about interference in elections. This is really ripe for a massive problem, don't you think?
Oh, it is. And I think back to, remember the turn of the century, there was a big deal about the supposed robber barons who had, you know, so much power. I mean, that's one of the reasons we passed the Sherman Antitrust Act, et cetera. Those guys were amateurs in comparison to the kind of power that Zuckerberg has with this this application and this basically modern form of communication that is used all over the world. I mean, it's amazing how much authority he's got and how much he can control the information flow depending on who they decide to censor.
And how completely unaccountable he is for the actions, which could translate into the margin of victory in elections in this country, make no mistake about it. Hans, where do you come down as a serious, you know, thinker on these matters on what should be done about this? Are you in the camp of having the government get into the regulation of these guys, or might you be interested in an approach that I found compelling, hearkening back to the Ma Bell breakup of the Bell system? Have a free market approach, let the market compete, but end this monopoly, in not just in Facebook, but by the way, you know, Google and Microsoft, perhaps Apple. I mean, these are really hegemons now in the information space, are they not?
I actually agree with you. I look, what can be worse than having Facebook acting as a censor, but having the government act as a censor? You know, that's jumping from the pot into the fireplace. I think there needs to be a serious examination of Facebook and other companies under our antitrust acts, in the same way we broke up Ma Bell and came up with all the companies today that everybody uses for their cell phones is all because of the competition that was created after we did that. And I think that is a serious possible remedy folks need to look at.
Okay. Listen, very quickly, sanctuary states are something that you have been tracking and trying to warn against in cities. Jerry Brown, the governor of California, has, as you know, reluctantly agreed to send 400 National Guard troops to the California border at President Trump's request. Does this mark in any way a change of view on the part of the governor of California, or is it more of the same when you look at the rules of engagement?
You know, I think it might be more of the same because of the rules of engagement, which I think are going to severely limit the amount of work that the National Guardsmen can do in assisting the Border Patrol. I mean, I think overall it's a good idea for the president to do this because the Border Patrol, they need help.
We have to leave it at that. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for your time today. Hans, we'll talk with you again very soon. Thank you, my friend, in the meantime. Next up, Bill Marshall joins us from Judicial Watch on tax dollars for Soros and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a delight to be able to have with us another representative from one of the most important organizations by my lights in Washington, D.C., Judicial Watch. We spoke yesterday with the president of the organization, Tom Fitton, and today we're able to visit with one of his senior investigators, Bill Marshall by name. He is a contributor to American Thinker. He has extensive experience in government and out in investigations and the kind of deep research that has informed much of the work that Judicial Watch does and has been just simply incalculably important for the rest of us, particularly in the absence of much in the way of congressional oversight, which is so desperately needed in area after area. One of the pieces that Bill Marshall wrote up the other day, which caught my eye, involves a particularly egregious problem needing government oversight, namely the use of American taxpayer dollars to support the work of George Soros and his Open Societies Foundation and related initiatives. Bill Marshall, thank you so much for digging into this and for joining us to talk a little bit about it. Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back, Frank. Thanks very much.
So what on earth would the U.S. government be doing? I mean, George Soros has more money than God the last time I checked. Why should taxpayer money be involved at all? But even more so, in the Trump administration, what on earth is going on having government funding going to a guy like this with an agenda that is so insidious and inimical to our national interests?
Well, that's a great question, and that's something that Judicial Watch has been digging into for the past year now. I've been looking at Soros' operations, for example, in Macedonia, Romania, Colombia, Guatemala. We're also looking, one of my colleagues is looking at Guatemala.
Albania is another one I hear.
Albania, yes. Albania is the one that we just got records from. And what's, as you said, what's really concerning is that USAID has been funding NGOs, these, you know, non-governmental organizations that are set up by George Soros and his organization, the Open Society Foundation, all over the world. And I'm talking scores and scores of these things. And they almost invariably promote these radical sort of leftist agenda issues.
Oh, wait, I'm shocked. Shocked.
I know. There's gambling going on here. You know, the pro-legalization of marijuana, the pro-LGBT, pro-socialist groups. He basically tries to stir up particularly the young, the pliable minds. And in many cases, and I think we've talked about this before, he tries to unite the radical young leftists in many of these countries with the local indigenous Muslim populations in some of them. And like we saw that in Macedonia.
The red-green axis, we call it.
Yes, exactly. And usually to subvert conservative governments, pro-American governments, that is to overthrow them in lieu of socialist governments that Soros is fond of. Now, for example, in Albania, we have the Socialist Party, which is run by a guy named the Prime Minister. They're named Edi Rama. The Socialist Party is just the refurbished Communist Party of Albania that collapsed when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990. The Communists sort of rebranded themselves as the Socialist Party.
There's a lot of that going on, Bill Marshall, as you may know, not just in Eastern Europe.
Well, that's for sure. South America.
Well, I'd say in the United States as well, in a lot of cases.
Right. Well, we could get into a whole other discussion about Soros' operations in the United States, but it's truly frightening what's concerning, his activities that are taking place really all over the world as well as the United States. You raised a good point. What is the purpose for George Soros, who has, you know, untold billions of dollars, to be seeking, you know, $1 million here or, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars there from USAID for these little organizations that he has set up or his group has set up in all these countries? And a terrific journalist named Leah Fowler, who is a former FBI agent who actually worked on Colombian and Mexican drug trafficking issues, wrote a great piece in the Daily Signal about a year ago. And she had a terrific insight when we were discussing this the other day. She actually writes about it in her column for the Daily Signal. And what she says is not the money so much that Soros is looking for. It's the conferral of legitimacy on these radical leftist organizations by getting money from the U.S. government. It confers a kind of respectability on what would otherwise be considered kind of crazy left-wing groups. And I completely agree with that, you know, because I was baffled by that, too. Why would this man who's got so much money be hitting up USAID for, you know, these relatively small, I mean, I'll say small, but, you know, hundreds of thousands or, you know, million-dollar grants or whatever to these various groups? Sure, it's great to have somebody else foot the bill, but there's more to it than that, and that is that as Leah phrases it, he's sort of laundering the image of these groups through the U.S. aid that's being provided.
And this is so insidious, and it's so much of a piece with the modus operandi of Soros and his minions to seek this kind of legitimacy and to use it to subvert American national interests. I mean, the irony of the U.S. government facilitating that against its own interests is quite remarkable. Let me ask you, since we're on the topic, to just say a word about Soros's operations in the United States. How much of this sort of thing are we seeing here as well?
Well, we know he gave something like $500,000 to Black Lives Matter. I mean, this is, you know, sort of classic, George Soros operation where you're stirring up trouble. You know, they are opposed to the police, as we know. You know, they essentially riot to protest, you know, the so-called killing of unarmed black men. I mean, never mind that unarmed people can inflict, you know, great injury on police officers and other civilians just as armed people can. But that's sort of a classic, you know, example of what he's doing here in the U.S. Most of our work relating to Soros has focused on the international aspects of what he's doing, because it's in those cases that we're seeing money flowing, U.S. taxpayer dollars flowing to support his organizations, which are actively promoting anti-American agendas and attitudes, if you will, in foreign countries.
One other example of mischief being made that I know you're working on at the moment, and I'd just like to give you a minute or so to talk about it, if you could, Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch, and that is what you've discovered about Obama administration policies with respect to our educational system that may have contributed directly to the disastrous attack at Parkland High School not so long ago in Florida.
Right. You know, there's so many researchers doing great work, sort of deep dive analyses of the policies that led to that disaster. And I've been digging into it a bit myself and trying to obtain records, particularly from Broward County, Florida, which was sort of the vanguard of this push by the Obama administration to reduce the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. Right. This was sort of a theory that's based on really truly a racialist view of America. That is that 70% or more of students that are arrested in American public schools are minorities, you know, blacks, Latinos primarily. The view of the Obama administration was not that the bulk of these people were being arrested for their underlying behavior, the behavior that led to you know, their discipline and their arrest. It was because they are being targeted by racist white teachers, right? So they created this, what they call the PROMISE program. This is preventing recidivism through opportunities, mentoring, intervention, support, and education. I'm surprised I got that out. But it was this classic sort of liberal program, which assumes that the arrests aren't occurring based on the face of the facts. They're a result of a, you know, sort of a racialist or a racist view, just like in the, you know, in the Black Lives Matter mindset. You know, blacks were being supposedly targeted by police officers, not because they were threatening the police officers or threatening other people, but because the police are racist, and, you know, implicitly or explicitly racist. The education year policies in the Obama administration were sort of an extension of the same mindset, the racialist mindset.
The fundamental transformation of America through attacks on every one of our institutions, in this case, the law enforcement as well as the educational one. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Bill Marshall, we are over time. Thank you so much for your joining us today, and again, for the work that you, Tom Fitton, and so many of your colleagues do at Judicial Watch. I pray that you will keep it up, and I know that you'll come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.